Thank you very much. Hope you are feeling a bit refreshed. If you can grab your Bible, I want us to begin. We're looking at the vision for the local church bit. And I want us just to begin in Mark chapter 10. So if you can find Mark chapter 10, that would be a great help, particularly verse 28 and following. Some time ago, I was speaking at a carol service at our church back home, and someone at the carol service had just come. It was the first time he'd been to church for possibly many, many, many years. And he gave the kind of feedback that any pastor longs for. He said, "I was really interested in what you had to say about Jesus, and would love to talk to you a bit more about what it means to follow him." And you're thinking, yes, this is what it's about. So he said, "Would it be okay if we maybe had lunch together and you told me a bit more about Jesus?" So clearly I had to, you know, really think that one through, and said, I think that would be okay. So anyway, I met up with him for lunch. He told me a bit about himself. He's a gay man, been in a relationship for a good 20, 25 years. And he said, "Listen, I'm really interested in becoming a follower of Jesus. I've just got to know from the outset, though, what does he think about my relationship?" And I remember thinking, that's not where I normally want to start in sharing the gospel with someone, but I thought, this is where he wants to start, so I'll try to honour that and try to walk him through some of the material that we've been looking at. And he was very patient, very kind, and said, so he said that the relationship I'm in is the best thing that has ever happened to me in my whole life. What could possibly be worth giving that up for? And I remember sitting there thinking, that's a good question. I remember saying to him, that's a really good question. I remember praying, Lord, that's a really good question. A bit of help here would be good. And a passage came to me, and it's this passage in Mark 10. And I was able to share it with my friend who's still in touch. He's still thinking about things. He's still not a Christian yet, but is still at least engaging with things. But this is the passage. We've just had the account of the rich young man who looked like such a prime candidate for a disciple. And he kind of bounced up to Jesus, kind of, where do I sign up? Count me in. I want to be a disciple. I'll do whatever it takes. And Jesus effectively called on him to deny himself and take up his cross in the kind of language that would most apply to this particular man. And he wasn't prepared to do that. And so he left the conversation, he left the encounter with Jesus very, very sorrowful. And we reading on are kind of gutted too. It's a bit of a downer. This guy looked so ripe for being a disciple, but clearly wasn't prepared to pay the price Jesus was asking of him. Peter, ever the emotionally intelligent disciple, decides this is the moment to brag about how good he and the others are at being disciples. So Peter says in verse 28, "See, hey, we've left everything and followed you." So Jesus, that guy may have just failed discipleship 101, but we're here and you've got your A-team with us. You know, Jesus, aren't you so lucky to have us on board as your disciples? And you know what? You're welcome, Jesus. You're welcome. And Mark tells us in verse 28 that Peter began to say this to him. So Peter evidently had a lot more of this kind of prepared and up his sleeve. But Jesus cuts him off in verse 29 and makes the most extraordinary promise. Jesus begins by saying to Peter, "Truly I say to you," which is a phrase Jesus doesn't use every time he says something, but it really has the effect of solemnizing, making more solemn, there we go, the thing that Jesus is about to say. "Truly I say to you" is kind of, okay, this is on the record, this is a key thing I'm about to say. Someone's going to put it on a poster one day. It's that kind of thing. And listen to what he says. He says, "There is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who won't receive a hundredfold now. In this time, houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, lands with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. Now, Jesus is just assuming that people will leave things to follow him. That's what he's always said discipleship's going to entail. People will leave things to follow him. Moreover, Jesus assumes the most costly things to leave will be relational and familial. There are some for whom following Jesus will mean leaving house, brothers, sisters, mother, father, children, and lands. Thankfully, that's not the case for all of us. Probably not the case for many of us, but there are some people who come from particular communities where if they become a follower of Jesus, they will not be able to return. And yet, as Jesus considers that prospect, that possibility, he doesn't say, and it's just really going to suck, but then don't worry because at the end you get heaven. No, Jesus says, even in the light of a cost of that magnitude, it's still worth following him, even in this life. He says that whatever it is we leave behind, he will replace in godly kind and in far, far greater measure. And again, he casts this in familiar language. When he says, you know, you'll receive houses and lands, he's not saying, hey, if you become my disciple, you will have an amazing property portfolio. That would be nice for anyone living in or near London, presumably. No, Jesus is promising, he's promising people. If I can put it this way, this is the true prosperity gospel. Jesus is not saying, hey, you give me £10 and I'll return it immediately with a hundredfold. He is saying, whatever you lose relationally, I will spectacularly compensate you for, even in this life. Now, as we read that passage, we may think that is a remarkable and beautiful thing that Jesus says. But I want to suggest that it's an unusual promise of Jesus because there is a significant extent to which this promise depends on us for its fulfillment. We are the brothers, the sisters, the mothers, the fathers, the sons and daughters that Jesus is promising to such a disciple. Psalm 68 says, God puts the lonely in families. Your congregation, your spiritual gang is one of the families God is wanting to put the lonely into. It is the family that Jesus is promising to the disciple who has to leave their own. So Jesus is saying that however much we lose relationally, it's never going to be a bad deal, even in this life. Here's my question for you, and I know there's a number of churches that have pulled together to make today happen. I don't know any of these churches, and none of these questions are loaded. But I want to give you a thought experiment. I want you to imagine, let's say a young gay man comes to faith in Christ. By the way, I hope you don't find that hard to imagine. It's really easy for God to save a gay person. He saved you. He can save you, he can save anyone, right? So imagine a young gay man comes to faith in Christ and ends up at your church. Maybe it was through your church he comes to faith. And for whatever reason, this individual is not able to go back into his friendship circles and community that he's been in. They don't want him back now that he's a Christian. So here he is, he's in your church congregation, and according to Jesus' words here in Mark 10, that person should be able to say that as a result of being in your church, attending your congregation, that person should be able to say, do you know what, I now have more family in my life than I ever had before. I've got more community in my life than I ever had before. I've got more intimacy now than I ever had before I came to this church. And my question for you is, can you imagine such a person saying that as a result of being in your church? If the answer is, I just don't know someone would be able to say that. Lots of things our church is good at, I don't think they would be able to say they've got all of these things now in a way that they never had before. If that's the case, friends, we're calling Jesus a liar. That really matters. If it turns out we think, do you know what? Yeah, our church is dysfunctional in any number of ways, but actually, yes. Someone turns up at our church and has no one else in their life, they will find real deep family here. Then we are proving to a watching world the answer to my friend's question at lunchtime. That if you come to Christ, whatever relationships may have to end, you will experience an overwhelming net increase in intimacy, not an overwhelming net decrease. Does that make sense? It's challenging, isn't it? It's challenging in southern England. It's not very our culture to be like this. Which means we need to be of a different culture, friends. We're called to this. So the question is, how can we become that kind of church? How can our church embody and exhibit that hundredfold blessing that Jesus promises? Wouldn't it be amazing if that's what our church was known for? If the people in our surrounding neighbourhoods are thinking, yup, those guys, they believe crazy stuff that is just not sensible, but I tell you what, people who end up there are always the better for it. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? In a culture that is increasingly lonely and isolated, if our churches actually were the place where people experienced a sense of family and community, I think that would turn people's heads. I think people would start coming to us in spite of what they think of our theology, but they just can't help themselves. So how do we get from where we are to that? Well, on the handout, I put a few things at the beginning of the handout there. Where is your church at on issues of sexuality? That's just a kind of, are these issues even on the table in our church? And I guess the fact that your church is part of today means, to some extent, yes, but it's worth just thinking through these questions. In your own church life, are these issues ever mentioned? If they are, is it only in the context of the big bad world out there rather than, hey, this is going to be part of the story for some of us in here? Is it an area we go anywhere near the youth with? Here's a good one. I was brokenhearted when a couple I know well at my church, and I kind of thought, my church is probably slightly better than most on this issue just because they've had to put up with me. But this couple said to me that their daughter had recently come out and they wanted me to know, and I very much appreciated that, but they said, we just don't think there is any way we could share that with our small group. Small group they had been leading for 10 years. So it's not as if they didn't have depth of relationship. But they just said, I just don't think people will relate to her in the same way if they know. That's really bad. Have you ever had a testimony at your church on this kind of issue? Just worth thinking those things through. So what do we do? Seven things you'll see on the rest of the sheet. Seven is the number for perfection and fullness in the Bible, so prepare to be disappointed. Number one, what do we need to do to get to this hundredfold thing? The first thing is we mustn't duck the issue. It's very, very, very tempting for church leaders to go nowhere near this. So up until about 5 years ago, perhaps, We have always been the weird ones when it comes to sexual ethics. People have always thought we are quaint and old-fashioned. Now, people don't think we're quaint and old-fashioned. People think we're dangerous. So the most common objection I hear when it comes to issues of sexuality, the most common objection I hear to the Christian faith is, your beliefs are making gay teenagers commit suicide. If that's the context we're in, what pastor's going to want to go anywhere near this topic? Whatever they say, they're going to get some emails on Monday morning and someone's going to leave the church. Whatever they say. But here's the thing, if we're not thinking through these issues in our churches, we're not going to remain neutral. It just means we're going to be exclusively discipled by our culture. Because every time we go online, every time we go on social media, every time someone shares the latest viral YouTube video, every time we go see a movie, we are being discipled thoroughly by our culture on how to think about these issues. So we can't afford to duck in. Actually, I don't think our culture is going to let us anyway. At some point it will pin us down and say, you've got to say something. Not saying anything is in fact saying something. And it's saying an unbiblical something. So don't duck the issue. Secondly, make it safe to talk about. In other words, how do we create the kind of culture where it's okay to bring up issues of sexuality that we may be struggling with? I was a Christian, I think, for 7 years before I ever felt like my own struggle with sexuality was something I could ever tell another believer about. I just assumed, well, you're not supposed to have these feelings if you're a Christian. I was worried that I would lose my Christian friends if they found out. I was worried that my church might not let me be involved if they knew. And I'd heard too many Christians making gay jokes, including some of the leaders. I had never been given any signal in 7 years that this was actually something it's okay for a Christian to be trying to wrestle with. The only time I did open up was because my pastor at the time was preaching on the second part of Romans 1, where Paul touches on issues of sexuality, and he just took a few moments in the sermon very gently to say, listen, this is going to be an issue for quite a few of us inside this building. And he said, if that's the case, we'd love to encourage you, we'd love to support you, please do let us know. And that was the first time I ever felt like, okay, oh, it's okay to say about this. The trouble is that we often tend to look down on this sin more than any other. I was doing a workshop for a group of pastors, actually not far from here once, on how can we reach the gay community with the good news of Jesus. And one of the pastors said, well, my problem is, how can you talk to a gay man without being disgusted by him? I thought, well, okay, you get some points for honesty and you probably lose a few more points for tact. There are any number of things you can say in response to that. I ended up saying to him, by being more disgusted by your own sin, brother. Paul describes himself in 1 Timothy as the worst of all sinners. It's amazing. Paul says, Christ Jesus came into this world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Now, I don't think Paul had done a survey of the entire Christian church at that point to find out who was the worst sinner. And then discovered it was him, you know. Had to be someone, turns out it was me, kind of thing. I think what Paul is showing us is that when you really know your own heart, it's very hard to imagine there's anyone out there who's more messed up than you are. As we were seeing earlier, Jesus really does level the playing field. You may not have experience of that kind of sexual temptation, but you do know what it's like to be messed up in your own sexuality. And if we really know that, we're not going to be those who are looking down on other people and feeling a sense of self-righteousness about ourselves. And friends, that means, again, we've got to do something in our churches that is very, very countercultural. We actually have to create the kind of culture in our churches where we're not embarrassed to admit how spiritually weak we are. I know too many churches where the basic rule of thumb is that the kind of oxygen people seem to inhale is, I have to look like I'm doing well as a Christian in order for Jesus to look good. And friends, that kills churches. That isn't the gospel. The gospel actually is, I need to be honest about my spiritual need so that Jesus can look sufficient to meet my needs. And a sign of maturity in the Christian life isn't that we gradually need Jesus less and less. Actually, it's that we need Jesus way, way, way more than we ever did in the past. So we need to make this issue safe to talk about, which means we just need to be making sin and weakness safe to talk about. It means we've got to be real with each other. We need to think through how we respond when people do open up. And when I first opened up to this particular pastor, I was still slightly terrified. It was all some ruse to weed out the kind of, you know, the faulty Christians and get rid of them somehow. But that the first two words out of his mouth when I kind of shared what I was struggling with could not have been more reassuring. He simply just looked at me and smiled and said... Because the first two words they said to me were, thank you. He said, listen, that sounded like it wasn't an easy thing to share, so I'm really grateful that you've felt able to share that with me. And I just suddenly thought, okay, this was the right thing to do. I'm glad I've done this. And he then just asked me a few gentle questions and said, how long have you been wrestling with this? And what have been the ups and downs for you? And what's it been like? And I can see the wisdom of that. Rather than immediately swooping in with what he presumed I would need to hear, he just took the time just to get a sense of where I was at and what the ups and downs had been along the way. There's an older guy in my church who often picks up waifs and strays, and he and his wife will kind of have people living with them for a while and trying to sort their lives out. And I remember him saying to me once, I've got to shoot home because there's this young guy coming around, he's in a complete mess, and I'm going to give him a thoroughly good listening to. And when people do open up on these issues, we mustn't then make this the primary lens through which we see them. As if, okay, this is this person's thing. We mustn't kind of define them by this one particular struggle. On any given day of the week, how many different types of sin do you struggle with that you're aware of, and then they add in the ones you're not aware of? It's quite a lot, isn't it? Number three, we need to celebrate the biblical understanding of sexuality. There's a couple of kind of components to this. Again, in our culture, the real you is who you feel yourself to be deep down inside. Your body is purely accidental and therefore incidental to who you are. But in the Bible, actually, our bodies are theologically significant. Your body is both a gift and it is a calling. David could say, even of his fallen body, that he had been fearfully and wonderfully made. So when it comes to our sexual feelings and when it comes to our bodies, again, I think the Bible would say that my sexual identity is not based on my sexual feelings, it's based on my body. So my sexual identity is that I'm male. My sexual identity is not defined by the particular proclivities I have or the particular forms of temptation I experience. My sexual feelings actually are a temporary feature of my experience. When I'm raised in the resurrection, I won't be raised with the same sexual feelings that I experience now. That's great news. But when I am raised in the resurrection, I will be raised with the same biological sex that I have now. And so my biological sex is part of my eternal identity in a way that my sexual feelings are not. And therefore it makes no sense to say that my sexual feelings are the core essence of who I am, whereas my biological sex is something entirely fluid that I can just switch around and change. Does that make sense? Second component is sexuality and fulfillment. Again, we were thinking earlier about how culture says that you have to fulfill your sexuality to be complete and fulfilled as a human being. That is actually really, really bad news, because if you're feeling as though you're not fulfilling your sexuality, then culture is saying to you that the best of life is passing you by. Your one big shot at being fully and authentically you are missing out on. And listen, make no mistake, we're often being told about mental health issues within gay teenagers. And it is a really serious issue. But we're not the ones telling young people that a life without sexual fulfillment isn't worth living. Culture's saying that. When it comes to sexuality, Jesus actually does two things. Yes, he draws the boundaries of where sexual behaviour is can be godly and blessed by God, and where it is something that is sinful. But more than that, Jesus actually dethrones sex. He shows us it is not the be-all and end-all. And one of the ways he shows us that is by being single himself for his whole life. Jesus was never married, was never in a romantic relationship, and never had sex. And so you can't say that any of those things are essential for human fulfillment without implying Jesus was subhuman. The Apostle John's word for when you imply Jesus is subhuman is antichrist. It's the spirit of the Antichrist to say that Jesus did not come in the flesh as a real and full human being. And the fact is, he was the most fully human and complete person who ever lived. So that tells us that however good and significant and profound a gift marriage can be, it's not essential for human flourishing. Number four, we need to honor singleness. For many Christians who wrestle with same-sex attraction, marriage is going to be unrealistic. Some find that they are able to meet someone who's, you know, kind of the exception to the rule, and they find someone that they have sufficient chemistry and attraction to be able to get married. But for many Christians, actually, marriage will be unrealistic, and we need to show in our churches that long-term singleness is a positive way to live and not a negative way to live. So we mustn't denigrate singleness. We mustn't treat it as if it's the kind of a sign that you haven't properly grown up yet. We mustn't imply that single people are kind of slightly irritating loose ends that need to be tied up. We mustn't imply that the basic unit of church life is the married couple with kids. I was at a conference about a year ago where a number of different people were feeding back on how their new church plants were going. They'd planted churches in the last couple of years, and they were feeding back to everybody else how those plants were going. And virtually all of them said something along the lines of, oh, it's been really encouraging because we've had some families join. I think, yes, that is really encouraging because families are people, and we want people in our churches. But the impression seems to be, yeah, we need families. The families are the key here. Not one of them said, you know, I'm really encouraged because there are some single folks who've joined our church. It's always, no, it's got to be the families, otherwise we can't really do church. A good buddy of mine actually is planting a church at the moment, and he's advertised it as a church for families, and I kind of want to kill him over that. I was speaking at a church a year or so ago, big church, big staff team. And I was doing a Q&A with the staff, and they said, how can we make single people part of the church family? I said, well, it would help if you didn't assume that they weren't. Because your question is assuming the church family is families, and then there's single people here, and we need to try and find some way of squashing them in. The fact that you're even asking that means that your whole concept of church family is wrong-headed. And again, we mustn't imply that marriage is somehow the kind of goal of the Christian life. As we were seeing in the first session, marriage is not meant to fulfill you, it's meant to point to the thing that does fulfill you. I love going to weddings. I don't love hearing Christians at their weddings saying things of their spouse that a believer should only ever say of Jesus. One guy saying of his new lovely Christian bride, but he said, you know what, she's the light of my world. I think, no, she's not. And actually, you're sounding romantic, but you're not actually loving her by saying things and expecting things of her that are only true of Jesus. Because Jesus didn't put her on the planet to be the light of your world. So we need to honour singleness. Next, we need to promote friendship. For many people who wrestle with issues of sexuality, the biggest battle is not sexual temptation, but loneliness. In our culture, intimacy and sex have been so collapsed into each other that we can't really conceive of any forms of intimacy that aren't ultimately sexual. So we hear previous generations speak about very, very deep friendship, and we roll our eyes and say, oh, well, they were obviously gay. But the fact is, the Bible shows us this, experience confirms this, you can have lots and lots and lots of sex and not be experiencing intimacy. And you can have lots and lots of intimacy that has nothing to do with sex. Jesus and Paul were both single. Both of them we see experiencing godly forms of intimacy. Contrary to our kind of the way we often imagine Paul was not the kind of lone ranger. If you read through Romans chapter 16, it feels like the end credits to the book of Romans because it's all the kind of greetings. But look at how many people were deeply embedded in Paul's life that he refers to them in family language. Paul was not on his own. With Jesus, we see he did life not just with the 12, but within the 12 there were the three that he was closer to. And within the three, there is the disciple, we're told, whom Jesus loved. And of course, a lot of people will leap on that and say, ha ha, they were gay. And that tells us far more about ourselves than it tells us about Jesus. So we need to promote friendship because in culture, friendship has been downgraded because all the kind of fuss is on the romantic and the sexual forms of intimacy. And we miss out on the broader categories of intimacy that the Bible gives us. In our culture, a friend is someone you add on Facebook. In the Bible, a friend is someone who knows your soul. Not just someone who sees the parts of your life that are Instagrammable, but the parts of your life actually that no one else sees. So John 15, verse 15 is one of those verses that I would never believe this was in the Bible if it didn't actually say it. But Jesus says to his disciples, he says, I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing. Instead, I call you friends because, and whatever Jesus says next is going to show us what Jesus believes friendship consists in. Jesus says, I've called you friends because all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Jesus says he's calling his disciples, he's calling us friends. That's crazy, right? But he says the reason we count as friends in his book is because he's really spilled the beans to us. He's let us in on what's going on. He's let us the whole way in. He's not holding back tons and tons of stuff from us. He's opened up all that the Father has revealed to him, he has made known to us. That is friendship. The friend is someone you tell your secrets to. It's someone who knows your inner life. And all of us need that, whether we're married or not. I've seen marriages implode because they don't have friends. The book of Proverbs shows us you cannot be wise in God's world without friendship. Number six, we need to provide good pastoral care for those who are wrestling with sexuality. That might take any number of forms, but we need to make sure people have those in the church family they can be open with, other leaders in the church who can kind of give them the encouragement and the help that they need. Some people will need accountability. Some people will need teaching and discipling. But we need to make sure that people are receiving the pastoral care that they need. And it will look different from person to person. And then the final thing is we need to remember that the church is family. Mark 10 has shown us this. Jesus is promising through us this hundredfold blessing. In 1 Timothy 5, Paul writes to Timothy, who's the pastor, and says, treat older men as fathers. Treat older women as mothers. Treat younger men as brothers, younger women as sisters with absolute purity. He doesn't say, treat older men as distant uncles. He's not saying your family in a kind of really broad, extended family that you see once every couple of years. He's saying, you are close family. Treat people as close family. Treat older men as fathers. Younger men, not as kind of second cousins that you kind of, you might know who they are vaguely, but you don't really know them. They treat younger men as brothers. When the Bible speaks of Christians as being brothers and sisters, that's not like an honorary thing. When we talk about the church being family, I hope it's not just because that will make us sound friendly. John Stott once wrote that unless our churches actually are a family, we have no business using that language at all and should repent of using it. So let me close with a verse in 1 Timothy 3. Paul is writing to Timothy, and he basically says, listen, the reason I'm writing you this is because I'm not sure I'm going to get a chance to say this to you face to face. So I'm going to put it in a letter now, and if I get to see you too, that's a bonus, but you've at least got my letter, if not. So he says in 1 Timothy 3, verse 14, I hope to come to you soon, but I'm writing these things to you so that if I delay, Southern Rail, you know, leaves, snow, this kind of thing, could be years before I get to you. If I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of the truth. So Paul describes the church as both the family of God and the pillar and foundation of the truth. Now, the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth because the church is God's outlet for his truth in the world. The church is the means by which God's truth is disseminated around the world. That's why we need churches everywhere, because we need the truth of God to be held forth through those churches. So the church is both the pillar and foundation of the truth, and Paul says it's the household or family of God. And I want to suggest that those two things go together, that they're bound up with one another. That if the church is going to be an effective outlet for the truth, it must be an effective family. If the church is not in any way acting as the family of God, that is going to undermine the credibility and the plausibility of the truth that we're seeking to share with the world around us. All of by which is by way of saying, the way we are going to win people in our culture on issues of human sexuality, again, is by what Jesus says in Mark 10. If people see folks flourish in our churches in a way they never would outside of our churches, that is going to make our message far, far, far more credible. That make sense? You up for that? Good.